Ben Lee is uniquely fascinating. You know him because in 2005, he released a pop song that reached ubiquity. And I feel confident in saying that you know who Ben Lee is because I know you know that song. It's the one that name checks Beyoncé with the bit that goes, "And that's the way I like it." He's the Catch My Disease guy, in addition to being one of Australia's most successful career songwriters. He's had enough hits to sustain a life in music for more than 20 years, and he's also my favourite Did You Know guy when it comes to Australian music. For instance, did you know that Ben Lee has also made an album about Islam? Or that he's worked as a death doula for people in hospice care? Or that he's sold essential oils? There's so much more. Cults, hallucinogenic teas, two records with the guy who plays Ted in How I Met Your Mother. Ben Lee is uniquely fascinating. And for the next 2 weeks, he's in coronavirus quarantine in Sydney, and I'm going to call him every day. I'm Max Quinn, and this is Ben Lee in quarantine. Okay, Ben, hi.
Hey, man.
Where are you?
I am in an apartment in Haymarket.
Mm-hmm.
On official day two of my quarantine coming in from the US.
So tell me about what your purpose is. What's your purpose in being back here?
That's an interesting one. Well, you know, I'm Australian, mm-hmm. and I've lived in the US for the most part since probably 96 when I finished high school. And you know, my career and family always kept me coming back to Australia, but I really built a life in the US. Mm. And I had my wife is American. My daughter was born there, my stepdaughter. So, I really built a life there. And it wasn't until, it was funny because I think on when the lockdown really kicked in, I think it was March or whatever it was in LA,
mm.
I was like, time to get my daughter her passport. I just started, because, you know, obviously going through the Trump presidency, it's been on, having a plan B has been on most people's minds. At that point, it seemed like there was no reason to think that countries were going to kind of handle it differently.
Right.
And it didn't seem at that point like Australia would necessarily be a better place to be than the US or any, you know, one place over another. But as the months went on, it just, the mixture of the political instability in the US and COVID, it just started feeling like it's crazy not to be here when we have the opportunity to. And not to mention, like, I'm an artist, you know, I'm a working artist. Like, I go where the work is, essentially. And I haven't played a paying gig this year.
Yeah.
And, it just became more and more a sort of pragmatic, in a sense, like sort of a blue-collar decision, but also a lifestyle decision. Like my daughter wants to go to a gymnastics class and wants to be around friends. And it just started seeming more and more like it was worth formulating a plan to get back here.
So what's the plan? How long are you here for?
Well, we're calling it, it's funny with plans because they're sort of important for your own sanity.
Yeah.
But I like to make them with a degree of just sort of understanding of their insanity, the innate insanity of having a plan in itself as you're trying to keep yourself sane. So like in our minds, we realized that we didn't have a plan. We were like, let's go to Australia. And then we realized it was kind of giving us all anxiety of different kinds to not have at least a rough sense of what we were going to do. So we're calling it a year and we're saying, let's go for 2021 and my daughter will do year six. But really ultimately, especially as artists, we're much more at the mercy of work and opportunity as we always are, you know, like my wife's an actress and director and she, you know, she'll want to go where her work is too. So we really don't know, but the plan at the moment is to spend a year and be here.
It's interesting. You talk about staying sane and you have submitted yourself to this objectively insane process. How are you dealing with it?
Interestingly enough, it's been really a massive sense of relief and relaxation for us.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what I think we're trying to process is the emotional trauma of being in America for the last 4 years, but particularly the last year. It has been hugely traumatic, not just being afraid of COVID and knowing people who have died and knowing people who have been hospitalized and all of that. And then, but then in the face of then you have also a portion of the country who doesn't believe there's even a real thing happening. So there's the trauma of that. I'm a firm believer that everyone's allowed to have their own political outlook, and I don't judge people for being conservatives or Republicans or, you know, Liberal Party or whatever. Like, everyone's entitled to have their own beliefs and morals. But when you look at the complete lack of grounding in reality, it's almost like there was like a schizophrenic, like a psychiatric break that occurred within American consciousness. And you literally have a country that has created, you know, there's always been this like disparity between the rich and the poor.
Sure.
But there's now disparities between realities. There's actually people are living in entirely different realities. With the country now has a group of people who, a large group of people who are refusing to accept the outcome of an election, which is really... it's unprecedented. Like, even though, you know, I'm on the left side of all of this.
Sure.
And I was not thrilled when Trump got into office. And I did believe there was foreign meddling in that. But I still accepted it.
Right.
I still went, okay, the guy won the election, fairly, unfairly. Who cares? Let's move on and see what we can do to make the world, make the country manageable and still continue to, like, tackle big issues like climate change and racial justice and things that need to be dealt with. But when you have... a complete lack of reason dominating a large segment of the population. It's really disturbing. It reminds me of when I went to the Opera House in year five and I pulled out a sandwich and we were watching some kind of concert and I pulled out a sandwich and I was eating it. I was behind one of the subscribers. So it was like an old, you know, blue rinse kind of patron of the Opera House. And she turned around and she said to me, you're not allowed to eat in here. And I just took a big bite of the sandwich. I said, I'm not. And obviously this is the kind of like mean-spiritedness that a 10 or 11-year-old can enjoy, particularly a boy. But essentially that's the state of affairs. It's really bizarre.
So how do you justify that as an artist, as someone who's making music? I often think about how I would approach a conversation with someone like that who sees things in an opposite way to me, experiences a different reality to me, and how I would put myself in their shoes, because I feel like that is how you gain empathy and earned understanding. But so much of this feels like it is so off-kilter, so off-balance that I can't understand it.
Well, I think there's two separate conversations in that. One is, how do you have empathy? And then the other is actually about the mechanics of talking to the other side.
Yeah.
As far as empathy, I do understand it because I've been involved in some pretty weird shit in my life.
Yeah.
And I was not necessarily receptive to people explaining to me with logic and reason why I was wrong. And I've been driven through my own wounds or childhood fears or desires or ambitions to wish against all odds for something to be true that it wasn't. I mean, I've lived that. So I understand that. And I don't... Another issue, and I'm sure we'll talk about this if we're going to talk a lot, but I've been very involved with fighting this thing that's been going on in America and in the world called QAnon.
Yes.
And what you realize when you start looking into QAnon and the effect that that has had is that human beings have never been subjected on this current scale to an intentional disinformation campaign designed to disrupt democracy and sanity. So through digital means, it's just never happened. So the idea of blaming people for falling for it is pointless, because how would we possibly have the skills to defend ourselves against it when it's brand new? So this is, I don't blame people for getting wrapped up in this way of thinking. Now, when you get into how do we talk to each other, the saddest thing about this moment is I'm not actually sure that it's possible at this moment.
Right.
It's literally talking about, like, on a battlefield, armies coming at each other and saying, well, how do we talk? It's like, well, it's gone a little bit beyond that. And I actually was on a call this morning with some different activists, and one of the people on the call was a Republican who went against Trump. And he said, this is not the time for olive branches. They don't want it. They don't want it.
Right.
Don't reach out with it. It's what you need to be doing is strategizing, mobilizing, coming up with ideas of how do you fight disinformation? How do you help marginalized communities? And how do you prevent, like, what I've been interested in with, especially with this sort of conspiracy social media world that has sucked in a lot of people I know. My concern has, there's a certain group of activists within the community I work with who are like, how do we talk to these people who've been red-pilled? How do we bring them back? And I was like, dude, waste of energy.
Right.
What you need to be talking to are the people who are in the process of getting red-pilled.
Right. Okay.
Those people are like two Facebook posts or two YouTube videos away from going all the way down the hole, but they haven't fully bought into it yet. Those people are still receptive to conversations. But when you're trying to like change people's minds, you don't start with like, you know, jihadists. You start with people that are on the line, you know, on the line and kind of right. going, I could go this way, I could go that way. So I don't think that we should, in this present moment, it's not that we should be preaching to the converted, but we have to be realistic about how radicalized a portion of the population has become, and doing what we can to not ensure others don't get radicalized in the same way.
Well, you're preaching to the precipice.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good phrase. Did you make that up?
Yes.
I like that. I'm going to use that if you don't mind. That's
you go
great.
Right ahead. So my thought on that is that, well, firstly, let's hang on. I want to backpedal about 10 steps because you and I don't know each other.
Now that's how talking to me is though. So get ready.
I hit you up with this idea yesterday afternoon. Like I was like, I can see that Benley is in quarantine. Ben is in lockdown. Less than 24 hours later, we're here. We're talking about the communities that you're involved with, finding our most vulnerable and how we protect them and red pilling the whole bit. Why did you decide to do this with me?
Okay. So I'm in this thing for 14 days, right?
Uh-huh.
And for my own sanity, I like to be busy and I like to be creative and I like people. So being creatively engaged with human beings sounds fun. I'm also interested in documenting it for my own posterity, you know,
right.
just so that whether it's keeping a journal or something, it's a fun idea, the idea that, fingers crossed, I never go through this experience again. Not that it's that awful, but it's something you hope the world doesn't require.
Right.
So that for sure made sense to me. And also I think part of the position I find myself in is that through the luck of the draw or the weirdness of art and time and timing, my music in the last 12 months has taken on a new resonance with people. And it seems that there is an opening to my outlook or my ideas in a way that I've not felt for a while. Mm-hmm. And so not just when I talk about there's work to be done, it's not just about money. The reason to come to Australia, come home with my family is that it has to do with receptivity. That as an artist, yeah, you want to get paid, but honestly, like if I'm getting paid enough for my family to eat and we pay the mortgage and all that, I'm happy. Like I don't need to make tons and tons and tons of money. That's not the end game. The end game is the sharing of ideas.
Right.
And I'm always looking for opportunities to share ideas. And this experiment that you had in mind seemed like a worthwhile way to talk and share.
I'm really interested in the idea that we move in and out of receptive phases in our lives. And I think truly that this is one of those years for a lot of people where we are considering what else is out there, why things have gotten to the point that they have gotten to. What have you found in having these kinds of conversations with people about why people are more receptive this year?
I wouldn't broad stroke say people are more receptive.
Mm-hmm.
I just meant to my music
to you,
and
to
conversation with me. I feel receptivity.
Yes.
I think some of that has to do with that the themes that I've been interested in my life have to do with passion and connectivity and positive attitude, even in the face of like drama or disaster, those are useful tools at a moment like this, right? So that kind of makes sense. I also think that there is a reprioritizing going on, like spiritually, psychologically, philosophically. And that's exactly why a lot of people have gone down this like red pill conspiracy theory world, is because it explains things to them in a way that when we're hungry for change and we're hungry for answers and we're hungry for comfort, we are open to answers. Like, you know, there's a lot of stories about people who get involved in, say, cults or abusive relationships.
Mm-hmm.
It happens at, or even like getting scammed by a tarot card reader who they end up like giving thousands of dollars to like cleanse their family history or whatever, you know, these kind of things, they happen at vulnerable moments because we want answers. I think for me, I've lived that process very intensely in my life. Like I've made a lot of mistakes. I've gone down a lot of dead ends and things, but I've always gone down them with like a total uncompromising passion. And I've always been really interested in what happens if you turn everything on its head and you open up to a different way of thinking. And I don't know, that just seems to be where a lot of people are at. I wouldn't necessarily mean it's like I'm like ahead of my time in some way or something. Mm-hmm. It's just this process of crisis and transformation is one that I've been historically interested in. So it gives me a unique perspective. I mean, those are the kind of people that I think we're curious to hear from at the moment.
How do you know when you're wrong?
Honestly, I think it comes in three ways. I think it comes in from inside you. I think there's as much as we try and ignore it, there is a vague whispering of conscience that tells you, I don't know. We generally overlook that, generally, right? Then secondly, it comes from people who love us and that we love. It has people basically going, you might be wrong about that in one way or another. And we often overlook that too because our arrogance and our pride forces us to think, oh, they have an agenda or they just don't understand or whatever it is. And then thirdly, it happens through things going wrong in our life.
Right.
Whether we get sick or people leave us or we lose money or we follow ideas and they end up like bad, you know. But I think it sort of usually escalates. It usually starts with like you get the opportunity like from your own heart and conscience and then you ignore that. And then it happens from like mild intervention from people around you. And then thirdly, like your life actually falls apart one way or another.
How many times do you think that's happened to you?
I mean, I almost think that like if you quantify it specifically, you're misunderstanding how profoundly wrong we are and how often we're profoundly wrong. Like, yeah, I can point to big ones, sure. I can point to like the guru in India and like the whole, you know, and then kind of alienating my audience by like being deliberately obtuse. And, you know, I can point to those obvious ones. But I think actually what's more interesting is on a day-to-day level in our interpersonal interactions with our family, like with our kids, when we like tell them something and we're wrong.
Yeah.
And we have to admit, it's like, it happens all the time. And what I've realized is like fundamental to being a healthy human being is being able to admit you're wrong constantly, particularly marriage. I mean, there's like no way to have a happy marriage without admitting you're wrong at least a dozen times a day.
Right. Okay.
It's like, it's the only way to have healthy collaboration.
How are you handling then being in quarantine with your wife and with your daughter? Are you having to admit that you're wrong more frequently?
Yeah, and my stepdaughter too. So we have a 19 year old too. It's funny because like it's an adventure we're undertaking together.
Mm.
And obviously we're very fortunate and we could afford to pay for the quarantine hotel and the flights and organize the, you know, all that stuff. But I think where there's an openness that we have at this moment, you know, to both the kids, I said, my only expectation of you guys on this is that when people invite you to do things or go to things in this new life, you'll say yes.
Yeah.
Like I can't tell you what life's going to be like. I don't know who you're going to meet or what you're going to, but I don't want you to isolate and to become resistant because I think that is the way you shut down the whole process. So we've just been kind of focused on being like not knowing anything. and sort of showing up and saying yes. So really, ultimately, when you ask why I said yes to you, when you DM'd me, not even directly, we're not even friends. It was like in my filtered messages, which I only just opened on Twitter. I just thought, it's weird. I have that on Instagram. Theoretically, if someone wants to reach out to you, it's nice that they can. You can ignore it, you know. But basically, I said yes because I'm trying to model also for them how to say yes.
You watching the Jim Carrey movie?
No, but that I lived next door to that guy, Danny Wallace.
Oh, no way.
He wrote the book. He moved next door to us in LA with his family. So I got to know him a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, right. Was he a sweetie?
Yeah, he was really nice. Somewhat reluctant to do things within the community, which I thought was funny. It's fine. You know, they kind of had a little bit more of like a, they were a little insular, like, you know, he's British and everything and like really nice. Like I love them, but I'm so outgoing. I think I sort of terrify people. I'm like, come on, let's just all enmesh and be part of a giant community, you know? But anyway, it's funny when you sort of realize also that the art people make, it comes from a sort of profound need to explore these larger questions of how do we position ourselves in life, in community, in relationships so that we can understand what the hell's going on.
So that you can also live happily and comfortably, right?
Yeah, and also so you can dance effectively. Like part of this move for us is, I think in America, okay, so I think most people know this, but like, you know, our kids haven't been to school in person all year basically, right? Every parent is negotiating, how do I keep my kid having some self-esteem and feeling positive and feeling, you know, what I was interested in, I was like, okay, you know what this lesson really about is about how to pivot.
Okay.
I was like, because whatever's going to happen in life to these kids is going to involve several intense moments of pivoting in the face of crisis. And so me and Ione, my wife, said from the beginning when we started talking about this move back to Australia was, we're not going to run. We're not going to run in fear. We're going to move towards opportunity. Because I think it's a great skill in life when the walls start crumbling down, not to panic, but to go, where's the positive move? Where can we build something new?
Right. And effectively, that's what you're doing over the next 12 months here in the country. And how have you made income this year?
I mean, I've had a few. It's kind of interesting what happened was I woke up before this. See, this is another thing. It's like very tied into intuition, like how you deal with these situations. But I woke up about 9 months ago, like maybe in January. And I was like, you know what? We're a little asset heavy. Like all our money's in our house. Like we basically had our house paid off.
Right.
Because artists tend to do that. If you have a job where you have a contract with a corporation and you know you're going to make 100 grand a year, that's a very different way you live. When you're an artist, like I've had probably like 3 or 4 big paydays in my 25-year career, and then you live on the interim between those off those paydays. So when you get the chance to like pay off a mortgage, you just do it, you know? But I had this moment in January where I was like, there's no rainy day fund here. It's like we are asset heavy. It is all in the house. And I just said, let's take some money out. Let's do it. I don't know why, but we ended up taking a little bit of money out, and that's basically what we lived on.
Yeah, right. This year. Interesting.
And it was just, we got lucky, you know? It was really lucky. And look, it's still borrowing money from a bank that you have to pay back eventually. Yeah. It's not like found money, but that's part of the pivoting in life, I think. That like when something comes up inside you, a little bit of concern, and not like a paranoid fear or something, not like prepping, like, oh my God, we need thousands of cans of tomatoes in the basement. It's not like that. It's just feeling like, huh, we could rebalance things a little bit here.
Sure.
And that type of thinking has always, I've never regretted it when I followed through with that, not done in a panicked way, but done in kind of a calm way.
What do you think of the 5-second rule? Do you know, not the food theory.
When you drop a piece of, oh yeah, okay.
The other thing where, I forget who wrote this. There's a book called The 5-Second Rule, and it's about the idea that if you have an impulse, you have about 5 seconds to make up your mind to positively act on it, otherwise it vanishes. Is that the sort of thing that you're describing here, where you have this impulse and you're like, okay, feels like this is something that I need to do, let's go.
I don't think you have to decide to act on it. but you do have to honor it and make note of it. So like, for instance, take a song idea.
Yeah.
Because that's an example like that. You get a song idea and I go, you know what? I'd love to write a song called, you know, MIDI plus keyboard. As I hear, I've got, I'm looking at a keyboard in front of me. So, and I get that idea. I don't have to write the song in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't even have to commit to writing it, but I might want to write it down within 5 seconds. I might even want to just remember it and go, hey, mental note, MIDI plus keyboard could be a song.
Could be an idea.
In some way, honoring the fact that that impulse has come up. And then I actually am, especially as I get older, I'm kind of into marinating on those ideas a little longer and trusting that the good ones remain. But I think you do have to build up a certain type of inner fortitude for that process.
Mm.
Because it's almost anxiety provoking. Ideas that want to be expressed. My feeling about them when I was younger was, it's almost like sexual. Like, it's like, oh my God, I'm going to come. It was like that. Like when you've got an idea, right?
Yeah.
And as you get older, sexually too, you know, in every sense, you start to be able to like slow your roll a little bit.
Sure.
And sort of enjoy the process and marinate and stew in this like sensual delight of creativity. And I think for me, a lot of it has been about trusting that, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to take note, but I'm also going to store it up for the right moment and I'm going to act on it. It's like being a fighter or something. You've got all the tools and you can act on them at the right moment.
Right. You read and react.
Yeah.
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 The other interesting learning for me from this already has been that having a great big pop song like Catch My Disease does not set you up for life.
Yeah, I mean, look, in some ways it does. I probably live... artists are not known for having the most measured, frugal existences. There are probably lifestyles that Catch My Disease could have set me up for life.
Yeah.
I don't live that lifestyle. And I also, if you live with the image in your mind that there'll never be income again, that's actually, like, super depressing.
Yeah.
One of the big things for me... when I was turning 40, was I suddenly realized, I actually put on Twitter one night, I said, who are your favorite artists who made their best album after 40? And I sort of thought maybe there's one or two. And I got back the most splendid list of artists, like Tom Waits, Bonnie Raitt, Willie Nelson, Nick Cave, Leonard Cohen. Like, I mean, incredible artists that also... are in my genre. They're singer-songwriters.
Sure, yeah.
And I started realizing that, like, I'd been carrying an image that was like a rock and roll image in my mind of, like, the, you know, Rolling Stones type or, like, Nirvana, like, young, sexy energy that has to explode, like, the Strokes or something when you're 20. But the reality is that the a much more appropriate model for creativity is one where my craft should continue to develop. And actually with singer-songwriters, the more wounds and the more disappointments and failures and successes you carry, the more resonance your work takes on as you go on. You might not have a hit song on the radio, but damn straight, you're going to have people going through real things in life who say that album, that's the one that kept me company through that. So what I did was I made a playlist of all these artists. Only artists who made their best work after 40.
Mm-hmm.
I just played it all the time. And I was like analyzing, like in an unconscious way, like not like Rivers Cuomo at Harvard analyzing Beatles and Nirvana song structures, like trying to find the common thread.
Right.
You know? And what I felt was a calm and a commitment, but an ambition that was still there. It was like ambition the way I used to feel it. When I was like 19, 20, 21, like breathing tornadoes, it was like an ambition that wanted to burn down a house.
Yeah.
It was like an ambition that wanted to destroy everything. It was like, I'm going to become so successful that it's going to hurt everybody. That was the way I used to think about it. As you get older, ambition becomes more like about making something beautiful that adds to the world. And that's what I started hearing all this music. And in a way, I created a possibility in my mind. And then over the next 12 months, I really believe I've written the best songs I've ever written. And I'm sort of, because I've been in that mindset before, I'm not entirely trusting of it.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, every artist thinks that. Come on. Every artist says like, oh, yeah, this is my best stuff, you know. But I started playing it out and I had people coming up to me going, this is the best stuff you've written in like 20 years.
Yeah, right.
And I thought, okay, so I'm not crazy. Who knows whether it's going to be perceived as my best work ever, but there are going to be some people who think it is. And I'm sort of halfway through making that record. So anyway, all of that ties into this idea of, as an artist, do you believe the journey's over or do you believe there's going to be more? But is that delusional?
Yeah.
I mean, these questions are crazy because you also sometimes meet people that, I don't like the term washed up because I actually really believe that creativity can come from a place you least expect it to.
Yes.
And man, I mean, everyone says it, like when someone has a major comeback in some way, everyone's like, oh, I always knew they had it in them. But no, they didn't. No one knew except that person.
Yeah.
That person was continuing on against all odds and convinced people to give them money for it or, you know, whatever it was, let them make the movie, let them write the book.
Uh-huh.
So there's no answer to this thing. Like there is a type of insanity in creativity that you have to hold on to. And I don't know, you know, we'll see. But I could never... all of this is in answer to the fact that, which I've never talked about in an interview before. It's funny. I'm glad I hope this is indicative of where we're going to touch some new spaces in all of this.
Me too.
But but I do think that had I lived in a way that almost like the most ruthless, financially ruthless manner possible, where all the money made from Catch My Disease was put into the right stocks and bonds and with the right returns and dividends, and I wouldn't be an artist.
Right.
I'd be an investor.
Yeah.
And that's not who I am.
You'd work for the bank.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to do that. And I'm okay with the risk. Honestly, like there's been enough risk in my life. And this is a beautiful moment for our family because it's full of risk.
Artistry is risk.
Yeah, and life is full of risk. And to be able to, for people to come together as a family and risk together, going, let's take on a new adventure together. I don't know how it's going to be, but I got a good feeling about it. That's an artistic move. And that's always been the way I wanted to have my family operate.
I think it's a lovely note to leave it on, Ben. Let's pick it up tomorrow. I'm excited to talk to you again.
Right on, man.
Thank you. Talk to you tomorrow. Ben Lee in Quarantine is a collaboration between me, Max Quinn, and Ben Lee. I'm doing all the mixing and producing and editing and stuff. Sorry if you run into any pops or clicks or bung audio. I'm trying. Thank you to Ben. You can find him on the internet at Ben Lee Music. You can say hi to me at Max Quinn. We'll have another episode for you real soon.